You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. We're getting an update now on the Kyle Rittenhouse case, the teenager charged with fatally shooting two people during the Kenosha protests. On August 25th, hundreds of people took to the streets to protest the police shooting of Jacob Blake, who is black. Now a judge has modified the conditions of release for Rittenhouse. How do you feel about him seen at a bar, allegedly with members of the Proud Boys? It's 800-642-1234. Bruce Velmetti covers courts and legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Bruce, welcome back to the Ideas Network. Hi, Bruce. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Sure.
So Rittenhouse turned 18 earlier this month, and he was charged, as we know, with killing two protesters, wounding a third during the civil unrest. What do we know about the original bail conditions for Rittenhouse's release?
The original bail was most notably $2 million. That's what we knew about it. And when I think people were surprised that they actually posted the bail, which of course was raised from among donors in the public. It wasn't from his own family or a single source. And when he posted it, he'd already been in jail in Kenosha, I forget, a week or two, and he was released after posting the money, and there wasn't really a big hearing to lay out a bunch of conditions. Typically, though, the typical conditions are you're not to have any contact with victims or witnesses, you're not supposed to leave the country, you know, things like that. But it wasn't really detailed and specified in a hearing like it is sometimes.
Why wasn't it spelled out in a hearing?
I'm not clear. They just didn't decide to have a hearing because he brought the money in, I believe, on a Friday afternoon, maybe even on a Saturday. And they just had the hearing, I'm sorry, the conditions, sort of the standard conditions applied for release. So when these other conditions came up, you know, they were unusual anyway. And I think if we're about to discuss like the alcohol and such, he was only 17 at the time. And I don't think anybody thought of that, make that a condition, because it wasn't really an issue at the time.
So images have surfaced of him at Pudgy's Pub in Mount Pleasant. What do we know about these images?
That's interesting. That was the afternoon of his arraignment. He had appeared via Zoom from his lawyer's office. His lawyer's office is in Racine. And after the hearing, when he made his formal entries of not guilty plea, he went to this tavern with his mother. And it was within a day or two. It was first on Twitter. Someone just posted on Twitter a picture of him with a beer and brought up the issue of what, and the T-shirt. It was really more about the T-shirt that he was wearing. And that got around on Twitter. And it wasn't until about a week later that prosecutors filed this motion to add these conditions to his bail. So really it was him being young, and I'm not sure the person who put it on Twitter realized he had turned 18 just 2 days earlier. Or maybe the person on Twitter didn't realize with his mother in Wisconsin, he was allowed to drink the beer. Doesn't look good, maybe, but that was legal. But it was the T-shirt.
And what was on the T-shirt?
The T-shirt said, "Free as..." expletive that you were saying on the radio.
How did the judge modify the conditions for Rittenhouse's bail?
Well, after this request by the prosecutors, he did add a condition that he not possess or consume alcohol, which is, again, that's a kind of a typical condition of anyone's bail. And it would also add, you know, or use illegal drugs, particularly if the case is like drunk driving or a drug case. But in this case, those weren't factors that would have normally prompted a judge to make that a condition. Plus, he was 17 at the time and no one expected him to be going to bars. The other more interesting one was that he's not to knowingly associate with anybody or any group that's involved in hate crimes or, you know, some broadly defined, I can tell you the exact language, basically don't hang out with hate groups or militias. Again, this was brought up by prosecutors based on these photographs that show him making an okay sign with these five men at the bar. And then that's obviously a sign that's now been kind of co-opted and often used by by militias and white supremacy groups. Now, Kyle's people, who are undefined, I think it's his civil lawyer, insist he had no idea that the OK sign has anything to do with white supremacy, that he didn't know these people when he went to the bar. And his lawyer said right away, he agreed to fine. We won't associate with those people because we don't anyway. So it was kind of a weird condition. He claims he never was, and he's not going to do it again, he says.
We're talking with reporter Bruce Valmetti, who covers courts and legal affairs for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he's been covering the Rittenhouse case. So, Bruce, do we know at all any connections that Kyle Rittenhouse would have with white supremacist groups?
We don't. I mean, this was the, his civil lawyer has been for weeks threatening defamation suits against the Biden campaign and various people who in the early days associated him with militias and white supremacy because of the photos from that evening in Kenosha. And they've insisted all along, he's just a kid. He's not part of any group, that he doesn't even have any affinity, I would believe is their language, for such groups. They weren't able to connect him online to these groups. But the pictures are very interesting from the bar. They kind of speak for themselves. On the one hand, like I said, his lawyers insist he didn't know these guys. He didn't know what the symbol meant. Apparently, he didn't know about the song. They were also, according to prosecutors, they were serenading him with a song that is sort of the Proud Boys anthem, Proud Boys being one of the known groups, that was at the Capitol in Washington and everything. So that's his picture.
So how might these recent actions, these images, affect his case overall?
Well, according to the defense, the defense is trying to say this was a smear job by the prosecutors to even ask for this condition. It could hurt him, I suppose, if people remember that. And they do think that he was, in fact, sympathetic to or involved with these kinds of white supremacist groups. On the other hand, the publicity, even bad publicity, has been helpful to a degree to his own lawyer, this Los Angeles lawyer, who's his quote-unquote civil lawyer, who used this to kind of generate donations for the defense, donations for his mother, for living expenses, that kind of thing. That's an ongoing, evolving effort. And sometimes they use these blips of any news to try to generate more support out there among people who are sympathetic to Kyle.
And as we wrap up here, what are the next stages in his case?
Not much for a while. They're going over the discovery in the case. Since the arraignment, the prosecutors have handed over, flash drives and hard drives with all this video that we've all seen pieces of, and interviews and the usual things that prosecutors turn over, and they're going through that. The next hearing isn't until March 10th. After that, there's a jury selection date set for the end of March, although Rittenhouse's lawyer said earlier this month at the arraignment he doesn't think there's any chance that anyone would be ready to have this trial by the end of March. So I anticipate there'll be a lot of pretrial litigation for months to come.
Bruce, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Bruce Valmetti is a legal affairs reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Coming up, the primary election for the state superintendent of public instruction race is 3 weeks away. We meet the field of primary candidates, starting with Deborah Kerr of Caledonia. How do you feel about the State Department of Public Instruction? What changes do you want to DPI? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. With us for the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The nonpartisan primary election for the superintendent of public instruction, Wisconsin's top education post, that is 3 weeks away. Seven candidates are running in the primary ahead of the April 6th general election. We will meet the candidates in the coming weeks. First up, it's Deborah Kerr, the former superintendent of the Brown Deer School District. What do you want to know about her priorities for public schools in our state? It's 800-642-1234. Deborah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, good morning, and hope you're all having a great day.
Thank you. Good snowing morning. Let's start with, why do you want to be Wisconsin's next superintendent?
Well, right now, Kate, our kids aren't winning. We have tremendous achievement gaps that have been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. Our kids are not back in school. They're missing their teachers. The teachers are missing the kids, and we need to get back to business. We're losing vital ground in our educational programming, and I want to create a world-class education system for all kids in the state of Wisconsin because our kids deserve better.
As the pandemic continues here, when do you think schools should be holding instruction virtually? When should they be in person?
Well, I just want to do a shout-out to all the superintendents, district leaders, and school boards who've had to shoulder the burden of this pandemic, working along very closely with their health departments and their health professionals in their communities. I think what we've learned about this pandemic and this COVID virus is that it can be mitigated, and so we need to get back to school by mitigating the risk as much as possible. We know this is going to be around for a while, so I think if we start by vaccinating all of our teachers and our staff, we can get our kids back into the buildings a lot faster than we are now.
Okay, so you feel like teachers and staff should be receiving their vaccines before other essential workers, putting these teachers first?
Yes, absolutely. Our kids have been out of school for almost 12 months, and we have a lot of catch-up work to do. And the research is showing that some of our kids are more than a year behind in our education. So we're going to be in recovery for a long time. We're going to have to look at different ways of scheduling. And I think it's important that our teachers feel safe coming back to work. And I know that's what our communities are carefully weighing in as they make these decisions.
When you say new ways of scheduling, do you mean to fit in more time for content, more time for teaching?
Absolutely. What we've learned from the pandemic is that learning can happen 24/7. We don't have to be restricted to a very structured calendar or a school calendar. Kids want to learn at any time, and so we can schedule classes online, face-to-face, that could be on the weekend or in the evenings or before school. And I think we're going to have to carefully look at our summer months coming up because we have a lot of work to do. And so every community has different circumstances. And so as the next state superintendent, I would work with them to help create a very high quality summer learning program that meets the needs of their kids.
Would you be able to work that through with teacher contracts?
Yeah, I think that's going to be the critical piece. We need to be hand in hand working with our teachers. This is going to cost a lot of money. And because of my advocacy at both the state and federal level in my elected positions, I think I'll be able to work more effectively with our legislators and Congress people to get more funding for our teachers for increased salaries.
We're talking with one of the seven candidates running for state superintendent. Deborah Kerr is former superintendent of the Brown Deer School District. What questions do you have for her priorities? 800-642-1234. Deborah, let's look at that funding piece. How would you change Wisconsin's funding formula that determines how much state support goes to our schools?
Well, I think we've all been challenged over this last year with the pandemic in many ways, from economic workforce development. And so our communities are suffering right now. And so we just can't continue to rely on the taxpayers to shoulder the burden of education. We all need to come together. And so when our funding formula was created many, many years ago, it was only based upon a basic public education. And now there are many sectors that we need to take care of and make sure that we're serving the welfare of all kids. And so I would bring together business leaders, the people from the Department of Instruction, and those who've been doing school finance. They are the ones that understand the formula the best. And maybe we can tweak it a little bit so that we can create winners all the way around. So one example of creating a winner for every school district would be increased reimbursement for special education students. Because what we know is that funding has decreased over the last 10 years significantly. And those kids need more of our support, and they need more services. So if we raise the increased percentage of reimbursement, that frees up money from regular education to help meet the needs of our local school district.
Well, let's bring in a call. Samuel is with us from Wausau. Hi, Samuel. What is your question?
Yeah, just talking about the scheduling and stuff like that. And evening classes and weekend classes and stuff like that. And I'm all for all year round education, but I'm also for, you know, kind of in that exercise mode that your brain does need a break too. And so with internet access and with other schedules and other things to do in a kid's life, I think, you know, to extend it and say, now go online and watch this video so you're ready tomorrow and stuff like that, I think that kind of takes away from the well-being or the well-roundedness of a kid.
Samuel, thanks. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead, Deborah.
I was going to say, thank you, Samuel. That's a really good point. And so what I think each community needs to design a special program to best serve their kids. So like what I know right now, the Brown Deer students with this virtual learning, many of my seniors have been working. They've been scheduling their online learning around their work schedules and getting money to go to college or go into their next career post-secondary. So I believe it requires a very personalized and customized approach, because I know I love the summer, and as a kid, I think there's lots of activities that we have to do to kind of restore the social-emotional learning for all of our students. So that's a really good point, Samuel.
Samuel, thanks. Let's bring in Ty now in La Crosse. Ty, hi, what would you like to say?
I just was listening to, and I didn't get to hear the last caller, but I have children in elementary, high school, and middle school. And this pandemic, distance learning has been really hard on them. They don't get to see their friends, and they don't get taught as well. So they come home with homework. They get homework that they don't understand how to do. They can't get their teachers online. They don't have textbooks to look things up. So they're leaning on us a lot to try to teach them. And when I hear your guest talking about they're a year behind, I just don't think that we need to try to pack in 2 years in 1 year now to catch them back up. The nights and weekends and before and after school, we don't need to be putting more pressure on these kids, because this has been very, very hard on them. I just think we need to go back to the normal curriculum and teach them the way they were pre-pandemic rather than try to do a big catch-up.
Yeah, Ty's saying parents are really overextended in this education setup in the pandemic.
Yes, Ty, you as parents have just been heroic in all that you have been doing to support your children and the other in your community. So thank you for all your care and love and support to make sure that your kids are still learning. But what we see in some other parts of the state is that all kids are not learning very effectively. And I'm not saying to push it all into a couple months. I think this recovery plan is going to take 3 to 5 years. So let's be very pragmatic about it. Let's make sure we know where our kids are, assess them, and let teachers do that work, because they know best how their kids learn and what instruction would need to be happening to make sure that our kids are making sure they're growing in their proficiency level and on grade level. And so for some kids, that's not going to take very long, but I think we need to look at this as a very pragmatic approach. And I'm the only candidate that's come out with a statewide plan for school reentry, and I would start with our elementary kids first. And let's see how that goes and make sure that they have all the supports that they need. But there are other schools across the entire state that have been face-to-face since September. And so let's learn from our colleagues and how this all works, because I know our leaders are prepared and ready to go.
Deborah Kerr, how would you address Wisconsin's racial and economic disparities that divide student achievement across our state?
We need to get Wisconsin off the list of having the worst achievement gap in the country between black and white students. That has been the case for the last 10 years. This is reprehensible. My team and I have created a reading roadmap to focus on literacy that will help ensure that we get all kids growing and meeting grade level milestones and 80% proficiency over time. The other piece is we need to address the broadband access, not only for our urban kids, but for our rural school districts. I believe that robust internet should be viewed as like electricity, a utility that's so vital to our success, because it's not only about education that we need to make sure that these kids have this online access, but it's for business, it's for healthcare. And so we need to address this achievement gap and put a full court press on it right away to make sure that our kids are learning and growing. And I think we can do that with my Science of Reading program that will get better results because of the evidence-based research that proves that.
Very quickly, as we wrap up, how do you feel about standardized testing and when it should be used?
You know, it's only one measure of accountability. Obviously, that's important in our world, but I think our teachers know best and our school leaders, because the ongoing assessments are going to give more feedback all throughout a child's educational career. Those assessments are vital to our recovery from this pandemic. While standardized tests only tell you one story, our safe school report cards have the opportunity to tell you much more if we include other aspects of their learning, such as grade point average, attendance. So I'm excited to run for this position, careforkids.com. Check me out, and just honored to serve.
Deborah, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Deborah Kerr is a candidate for state superintendent. She is the former superintendent of the Brown Deer School District. Ahead this hour, we talk with the CEO of Prevea Health in Green Bay as they ramp up community vaccination. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This week, Wisconsin begins vaccinating adults who are 65 and older against COVID-19. That will greatly expand who is eligible for the vaccine here and could complicate the process. So far, the vaccine's rollout has drawn criticism from some lawmakers, healthcare workers, and frustrated residents. Shemaine Mills reports.
Vaccinations against COVID-19 in the country have been slow. Compared to the speed in which vaccines were made and approved, it seems downright sluggish. In the week before his inauguration, Joe Biden said as much.
The vaccine rollout in the United States has been a dismal failure thus far.
Biden has set an ambitious goal, 100 million shots in 100 days. To reach that level, states like Wisconsin would need a lot more vaccine than they've gotten so far, not to mention a workable plan to get shots into arms. Some feel the state's off to a rocky start. About 5% of the population has been vaccinated so far. GOP Assembly Health Chairman Joe Sanfilippo criticized the Evers administration, which is focused on getting shots to healthcare workers and in nursing homes while urging others to be patient.
For us to, you know, to wait till July to be able to get to the general public, that's not fast enough.
Across the U.S., less than half the 38 million doses distributed have actually been used. Many are still sitting on shelves. Some states are doing better than others. North Dakota, for instance, is vaccinating at twice the rate Wisconsin is, and West Virginia leads the U.S. in vaccinating nursing homes. Even with broad guidance from the state on who can currently get a shot, individual cases can present tricky dilemmas. Take Rita Baker, who recently contacted WPR's Wisconsin Project. Baker, a retired teacher who taught German to high schoolers in Connecticut, has temporarily moved to Madison.
Ich heiße Rita Baker. Ich komme aus Connecticut. Ich fahre morgen nach Wisconsin.
Baker is staying with her daughter and son-in-law, where she cares for her first grandchild, while the child's parents work.
With the pandemic, nobody felt comfortable sending the baby to daycare. He's just 2 months old at the time. And so my husband and I drove 15 hours to Madison, and I became a granny nanny.
The 67-year-old has pulmonary sarcoidosis, an autoimmune disease that affects the lungs. As the state opens vaccinations up to those 65 and older, a state board hasn't recommended prioritizing those with chronic health conditions. She'll qualify, though, because of her age. As of mid-January, doctors at community clinics around the state still hadn't been vaccinated. These are the doctors who treat lower-income patients. Many of them work with populations that are at high risk of serious complications from the virus. As community clinic staff get their shots, they also have to plan how to vaccinate patients with fragile vaccines that have very specific storage requirements and have to be used within 6 hours of opening. Dr. Allison Koss is with Progressive Community Health Center in Milwaukee.
Obviously, it can lead to restricting how many people you can schedule for vaccination, hoping that they come. And then in the event that they no-show for their vaccination, how do you scramble or how do you best use the doses that are left over so that you prevent waste?
States don't want to waste doses, and they don't have time to waste. A new, more contagious strain of COVID is circulating in the U.S., which threatens to worsen the pandemic. In order to vaccinate 80% of Wisconsin's population by the end of June, Deputy Health Secretary Julie Willems-Van Dyke says the state would need three times as much vaccine as it's getting now. And while the vaccine supply is expected to be steady in the next month, she said there's no indication it will increase anytime soon. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now a Green Bay healthcare system is partnering with UW-Green Bay to stand up community vaccination sites. We're learning how they operate. Have you received your COVID vaccine yet? What was the experience like? Are you 65 or older? Have you signed up yet? Was your appointment canceled? And if so, why? It's 800-642-1234. Dr. Ashok Rai is president and CEO of Prevea Health, which provides primary and specialty care to more than 80 clinics and hospitals in northern, eastern, and western Wisconsin. Dr. Rai, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
So Wisconsin opened up vaccinations to 65 and over. We're hearing reports of health systems saying they're getting inundated with appointment requests. What is Prevea Health experiencing?
Well, there's no doubt that there's a lot of demand in that age population, which makes us happy. They're the most at-risk population. They're the ones that we've lost the most of since this pandemic started. So obviously we have a focus on getting them vaccinated as fast as possible. And they also recognize their need to do that. You know, on Tuesday of last week, we were told we could do 65 and older starting to yesterday on Monday. And then they revised that saying if you had capacity in the week, you could start doing it earlier. So we did because we had capacity with our new site and sites opening up throughout the state. So it's been a great experience, to be honest with you, to be able to provide that. It's also frustrating for our patients because there's only so much vaccine available and our IT systems held up, phone systems. There's a longer wait time just because there's only so many humans we can get to answer those phones while still, you know, operating and ramping up as we go. But that hasn't been the picture across the state. You know, unfortunately, though, everybody wants to be able to book an appointment, but we won't book an appointment unless we know we can give you that shot. So it will be a week-to-week basis of us opening up more and more slots.
Yeah, so what are you telling people who do seek an appointment? Are they getting slots?
So ours are full for what we know or what we could predict on vaccine allotments, but we continue to ask the state for more, and if we get more, we'll open up more slots. So we've told people to be patient. Technically yesterday was day one. This week we will immunize a little over 6,500 across the state for shot ones. We continue to do shot twos. So we're giving more than 6,500 vaccines, but just, you know, the first shot in the series, and 96% of those patients are over the age of 65. So that's a good amount of people, but definitely not enough. We could do more if the supply was there. So people have to be patient as we get more supply from the federal government and it's allocated to us by the state, we will be able to do more. And it's the first week. This is a little bit of a marathon and people have to understand that. We understand their frustrations. We want to do more. We have the capacity to do more. But it's all about supply right now, not desire.
Dr. Rai, explain where you are standing up vaccination sites. How are you putting those sites together?
So it's really, we did the first site in about 4 days of construction. We called Chancellor Alexander at UWGB because they had three campuses in our market that we wanted to focus on, the first being Green Bay, the second being Sheboygan, the third being Marinette. And we're able to, get space from them in a great partnership. They've been fantastic to work with. System President Tommy Thompson has also been an amazing advocate for this. So a lot of obstacles were removed very quickly. And we, in 4 days, actually constructed vaccine rooms, check-in booths, observation areas, pharmacy, adverse reaction rooms so we can monitor patients. All of that was constructed at Green Bay. Construction is also done in Sheboygan, about to start in Marinette. And then on the west side of the state, we found an area that was a little larger for us than UW could offer us at that time and had a larger parking lot because parking is really important. So we'll be at Jacobs Well in Lake Halley because of our operations both in Eau Claire and Chippewa Falls.
Okay, so and these sites are either about to be up and running or up and running. The Green Bay site is at the Kress Center, I understand?
Yes, that's on the campus of the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay.
Yeah. So, you know, as you look at vaccine capacity and how many doses you will receive, do you get an alert every day? How do you know how many doses you'll get?
So on Monday, we get a form to fill out, and you have until Tuesday afternoon, evening to get that form done, to work with your teams to see what you have for staff, what you have for space, and how many vaccines you could give the next week. So you fill that out. So we did that last night. And then anywhere from Thursday to Sunday, and this is the difficult part to try to plan, we find out how many we're going to get. This means we get it between Thursday and Sunday. That's when we find out the amount, and that'll arrive anywhere from Monday or Tuesday. So it isn't a perfect system. They're doing the best they can, but that's what creates some of the backlog in demand, because until we know what we're going to get, we can't really open up appointment slots. We open up some knowing that we're going to get some vaccine, but you know, you don't know if you're going to get more or get less than you got the previous week.
We're talking with Prevea Health CEO, Dr. Ashok Rai, about the work of getting COVID community COVID vaccination sites online. Let's bring in Jane now in Suamico. Jane, hi. What would you like to say?
Good morning. I was at the Kress Center on Thursday last week to get my vaccine, and it was wonderful. The signage was fantastic to find my way in, which I'm not good at. And then once I was in, there was a guide to show me where to go. They had plexiglass up for all the administrators who received me. I had pre-checked in, so they just simply found me in the computer. I went to a person standing in front of the tent where there was a cubicle for me to get the shot, and she was ready for me. I went in, got the shot, sat out in the lobby area where they had spaced chairs, sat there for 15 minutes to make sure there was no adverse reaction, and I was on my way. It was amazing.
So logistically, very smooth. A thumbs up there from Jane, Dr. Rai.
Well, thank you, Jane. I appreciate it. You know, a lot of good people were involved to make sure it could be as smooth and safe as possible. It's not that hard to scale up, but to do it right took a lot of effort. You know, we wanted to make sure from every step of the way that as a physician-owned and run group that we were living to our Hippocratic Oath, which meant protecting everybody's privacy. So, you know, if you go to Florida, they're using an event planning app to schedule your vaccine. We didn't feel that that's a good HIPAA-compliant way, so we use our EMR to do it. We want to make sure that all the safety mechanisms and medications needed to deal with an adverse reaction were there like they would in any hospital or clinic. So we actually have an adverse reaction room with a crash cart and everything there, just in case somebody would need it, and hopefully they don't. So we set these up to be as safe and as good as any regular Prevea clinic would be.
We're talking with Prevea Health CEO, Dr. Ashok Rai, about setting up community COVID vaccination sites in Green Bay, Sheboygan, and beyond. Do you work for a health system currently setting up a large community vaccination site? What are the logistics like? What questions do you have? Join in 800-642-1234. Share your situation. Back in a minute with Dr. Rai here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Dr. Ashok Rai, CEO of Prevea Health, which is working, as we've been talking about, to set up COVID vaccination clinics around the state. They aim to eventually scale up to administering nearly 20,000 shots a week. Health systems are reporting, though, long wait times and a surge of appointment requests from people 65 and older who are part of this 1B phase of rollout. What are you experiencing? 800-642-1234. Let's take another call now. John is joining us from Shell Lake. Hi, John. What's your experience?
Well, I'm 71 years old. I've already had the COVID disease once and got sicker than a dog. But I've been leaving messages at Marshfield Clinic trying to schedule an appointment, but I don't even get answers back. So I'm just wondering, I don't want to get it again. So I was wondering, how long am I supposed to wait, or do I keep calling them? I don't want to be a pain in the butt. You know, but
Dr. Rai, do you have any suggestions there for John, who has had COVID?
So, you know, it's really important for those that have had the infection with COVID documented that they still get vaccinated as long as they've recovered from it. And that's usually after 10 days. So there's no reason to wait. The CDC would say that you shouldn't wait. And there's some good studies that are starting to be shown and some data on the outside. So not perfect science right now, but it's a evolving science that shows that the immunity generated from the vaccine is better than the immunity from having COVID itself. In other words, recovering from it. And once again, that's going to be, you know, parsed out in better science in the future. But right now, the recommendation is definitely get it. Understanding that those who are qualified to get it, 65 and older, that opened up this week. And this isn't an issue for the health system not wanting to answer your call or not wanting to give you the vaccine. It's really about getting the vaccine from the federal government. This isn't a state of Wisconsin issue. I'll be very honest with you. DHS has done an amazing job with limited resources, and the limited resource has been the amount of vaccines that they're getting. Think about it as we're getting the same size pie every week, but now the pie needs to be shared with more and more people every week, whether it be vaccinators or patients. It's going to the slices are going to get tinier and tinier. The population size of 65 and older in the state is over 700,000 people. So 70,000 a week, you can do the math. It's going to take a while. That's 70,000 shots coming in a week. So what I would say to you is definitely get your vaccine. You definitely need to get it at 71 with your medical conditions. Be patient with your healthcare provider. Understand that you can get your vaccine from more than one. You don't have to go to just your doctor. You can look at other health systems. Everybody's ramping up at different speeds, and everybody will get to a larger site situation at some point. Some people are just doing it faster than others. So know that you can go to another health system if you would like, but you know, keep trying and be patient. Pay attention to the news and the websites from the different healthcare providers.
John, thanks for that. You know, as you said, Dr. Rye, Wisconsin has suffered from a slow rollout. Logjam being not enough doses is what we're seeing. How should the vaccine be distributed to healthcare organizations around the state?
So I think that's obviously a politically charged, situation too. And you know, I wish the state wasn't in this situation. I wish the federal government would have increased the supply like they should have week over week, as should the manufacturers. We knew this was coming. The mechanisms, you know, should be there. They're not there. Hopefully they'll be there soon. And, you know, I think the philosophy of the state for the first month was appropriate. As vaccinators get approved, we want to make sure everybody gets something. That way vaccine is being delivered. As operations evolve in the state, and as larger sites that are more efficient in getting it in arms are created, we would hope that the state would recognize that a little differently. But that's not a switch you can flick overnight either. You know, there, you don't want to let people down in that process, and it's hard when there's a limited supply. But for example, if there's a site that can do 500 doses in a morning, and a site, you know, somewhere in that same region that requests 500 doses and said they're going to do it in the week, where would you want those 500 doses to go? You want it to be as fast and as efficient as possible, as long as they're in the same region. But then you also need to account for rural areas and making sure that we're getting doses to them and opening up sites in rural areas, just like we're doing in Marinette County and like we have currently in O'Connell Falls. So there is no great answer to this. Patience, I know, is an annoying word right now for many, but the state is going to need to, you know, continuously evolve its algorithm to account for how different sites are performing and making sure that you're getting doses to the sites that can get it into arms as efficiently as possible.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Ashok Rai, who is CEO of Prevea Health, and his healthcare system recently opened a COVID vaccination clinic on the UW Green Bay campus, has plans for rollout in Sheboygan, Marinette, and elsewhere. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Dr. Rai, are you being told which vaccines you'll be getting, either Pfizer or Moderna, or are you just taking what you get?
So the way it was initially sent out to us is that once you're locked into a brand, that's what you're going to get. And it's really based on your capability. Do you have the capability to store and manage Pfizer? Because obviously we've talked about that a lot, that needs a super cold freezer. And, you know, once you thaw it, you got to use it. So are you efficient enough? Do you have a right scale of operation that if you were to thaw Pfizer, you can get it in arms right away? Or should you be Moderna for other reasons? And each one has its pros and cons.
We're having some technical difficulty. Can you still hear us, Dr. Rai? I think we just we lost Dr. Ashok Rai, CEO of Prevea Health, as we talk about the vaccine rollout in Wisconsin. Dr. Rai is with Prevea Health, which is opening sites, has a site in Green Bay, Sheboygan, Marinette, Eau Claire area. You can join in with what you're experiencing, 800-642-1234. Dr. Rai, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you now, yes. We just had a little internet glitch there. Yeah, carry on.
All right, sorry, not sure where I cut off, but what I would say is generally you're either Pfizer or Moderna. Yesterday, the state started asking on the forum, are you willing to do both? So we'll see what happens in allocations going forward now.
Are you willing to do both? Is Prevea able to do that complexity of different schedules and the varying needs of these two vaccines?
Yeah, the varying schedules is really the challenge because the Pfizer increment is 21 days. The Moderna second increment is 28 days. So we worked last night as a team. We met as a team last night to say, how would we do it? It won't be easy, but we want to get shots in arms and we will make it happen. So if we were able to get both, we will give both.
Let's bring in Gary in Iron River. Hi, Gary. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Say, I just wanted to also say that you should call or look at your county health department up here in Ashland and Bayfield County. The county health departments are getting the shots, and I'm scheduled for mine later this morning, and my 93-year-old mother gets hers tomorrow. So that's another option. They do plead that you sign up online if you can rather than fill the phone lines.
Gary, thanks. So county health departments there, Dr. Rai, have also very good information and access.
Yeah, I would say, especially in the rural environments, county health departments are a key partner for us, not only in providing the vaccination, but also getting patients scheduled with us. You know, the local public health officers that we've worked with since March have been amazing during this pandemic and are continuing to step up even with vaccination.
As we close, when do you think our country will have vaccinated enough people to reach herd immunity?
It really comes down to vaccine supply. If supply continues to increase, right now it's steady state, and that's kind of an intolerable state. So we need the vaccine supply to increase exponentially, triple it, quadruple it. We could have what we would consider herd immunity, a good amount of people vaccinated by midsummer, early fall. But the longer we wait to get the supply to vaccinators like ourselves to get into arms, the longer that's going to take. And it's going to be hard to catch up. So we really need the government to get those doses out as quickly as possible.
Dr. Rai, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ashok Rai is president and CEO of Prevea Health, based in Green Bay, which along with other health systems is setting up community COVID vaccination clinics around the state. And for disclosure, Prevea Health is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we get a read on how our state economy is holding up in the pandemic. We have a longtime Wisconsin public policy analyst who is out with a new report that reveals how different parts of the state have weathered this pandemic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.